Theodor Reich, we learn to love only through rejection. As infants, we are showered with love by our mother. We know nothing else. But when we get a little older, we begin to sense that her love is not unconditional. If we don't behave, if we do not please her, she can withdraw it. The idea that she'll withdraw her affection fills us with anxiety and, at first, with anger. We will show her. We will throw a tantrum. But that never works, and we slowly realize that the only way to keep her from rejecting us again is to imitate her, to be as loving, kind, and affectionate as she is. This will bond her to us in the deepest way. The pattern is ingrained in us for the rest of our lives. By experiencing a rejection or a coldness, we learn to court and pursue, to love. Recreate this primal pattern in your seduction. First, shower your targets with affection. They will not be sure where this is coming from, but it is a delightful feeling and they will never want to lose it. When it does go away, in your strategic step back, they'll have moments of anxiety and anger, perhaps throwing a tantrum, and then the same childlike reaction. The only way to win you back, to have you for sure, will be to reverse the pattern, to imitate you, to be the affectionate giving one. It's the terror of rejection that turns the tables. This pattern will often repeat itself naturally in an affair or relationship. One person goes cold, the other pursues, then goes cold in turn, making the first person the pursuer, and on and on. As a seducer, don't leave this to chance. Make it happen. You are teaching the other person to become a seducer, just as the mother in her own way taught the child to return her love by turning her back. For your own sake, learn to relish this reversal of roles. Don't merely play at being the pursued, but enjoy it. Give in to it. The pleasure of being pursued by your victim can often surpass the thrill of the hunt. Reversal. There are moments when creating space and absence will blow up in your face. An absence at a critical moment in the seduction can make the target lose interest in you. It also leaves too much to chance. While you're away, they could find another person who will distract their thoughts from you. Cleopatra easily seduced Mark Antony, but after their first encounters, he returned to Rome. Cleopatra was mysterious and alluring, but if she let too much time pass, he would forget her charms. So she let go of her usual coquetry and came after him when he was on one of his military campaigns. She knew that once he saw her, he would fall under her spell again and pursue her. Use absence only when you're sure of the target's affection, and never let it go on too long. It's most effective later in the seduction. Also, never create too much space. Don't write too rarely. Don't act too cold. Don't show too much interest in someone else. That is the strategy of mixing pleasure with pain, detailed in Chapter 20, and will create a dependent victim, or will even make him or her give up completely. Some people, too, are inveterately passive. They're waiting for you to make the bold move, and if you don't, they'll think you're weak. The pleasure to be had from such a victim is less than the pleasure you'll get from someone more active. But if you're involved with such a type, do what you need to if you are to have your way. Then end the affair and move on. Chapter 22. Use Physical Lures. Targets with active minds are dangerous. If they see through your manipulations, they may suddenly develop doubts. Put their minds gently to rest and waken their dormant senses by combining a non-defensive attitude with a charged sexual presence. While your cool, nonchalant air is calming their minds and lowering their inhibitions, your glances, voice, and bearing, oozing sex and desire, are getting under their skin, agitating their senses, and raising their temperature. Never force the physical. Instead, infect your targets with heat. Lure them in to lust. Lead them into the moment, an intensified present in which morality, judgment, and concern for the future all melt away, and the body succumbs to pleasure. Raising the temperature. In 1889, the top New York theatrical manager, Ernest Jurgens, visited France on one of his many scouting trips. Jurgens was known for his honesty, a rare commodity in the shady entertainment world, and for his ability to find unusual acts. He had to spend the night in Marseille, and while wandering along the quay of the old harbor, he heard excited catcalls issuing from a working-class cabaret, and decided to go in. A 21-year-old Spanish dancer named Carolina Otero was performing, and the minute Jurgens laid eyes on her, he was a changed man. Her appearance was startling. 5'10", fiery dark eyes, black waist-length hair, her body corseted into a perfect hourglass figure. But it was the way she danced that made his heart pound, her whole body alive, writhing like an animal in heat as she performed a fandango. Her dancing was hardly professional, but she enjoyed herself so much and was so unrestrained that none of that mattered. Jurgens also couldn't help but notice the men in the cabaret watching her, their mouths agape. After the show, Jurgens went backstage to introduce himself. Otero's eyes came alive as he spoke of his job and of New York. He felt a heat, a twitching in his body as she looked him up and down. Her voice was deep and raspy, the tongue constantly in play as she rolled her R's. Closing the door, Otero ignored the knocks and pleas of the admirers dying to speak to her. She said that her way of dancing was natural. Her mother was a gypsy. Soon she asked Jurgens to be her escort that evening. And as he helped her with her coat, she leaned back toward him slightly, as if she had lost her balance. As they walked around the city, her arm in his, she would occasionally whisper in his ear. Jurgens felt his usual reserve melt away. He held her tighter. He was a family man, had never considered cheating on his wife, but without thinking, he brought Otero back to his hotel room. She began to take off some of her clothes, coat, gloves, hat, a perfectly normal thing to do, but the way she did it made him lose all restraint. The normally timid Jurgens went on the attack. The next morning, Jurgens signed Otero to a lucrative contract, a great risk considering that she was an amateur at best. He brought her to Paris and assigned a top theatrical coach to her. Hurrying back to New York, he fed the newspapers with reports of this mysterious Spanish beauty poised to conquer the city. Soon, rival papers were claiming she was an Andalusian countess, an escaped harem girl, the widow of a sheik, on and on. He made frequent trips to Paris to be with her, forgetting about his family, lavishing money and gifts on her. Otero's New York debut in October of 1890 was an astounding success. "Otero dances with abandon," read an article in the New York Times. "Her lithe and supple body looks like that of a serpent writhing in quick, graceful curves." In a few short weeks, she became the toast of New York society, performing at private parties late into the night. The tycoon William Vanderbilt courted her with expensive jewels and evenings on his yacht. Other millionaires vied for her attention. Meanwhile, Jurgens was dipping into the company till to pay for presents for her. He would do anything to keep her, a task in which he was facing heavy competition. A few months later, after his embezzling became public, he was a ruined man. He eventually committed suicide. Otero went back to France, to Paris, and over the next few years rose to become the most infamous courtesan of the Belle Époque. Word spread quickly. A night with La Belle Otero, as she was now known, was more effective than all the aphrodisiacs in the world. She had a temper and was demanding, but that was to be expected. Prince Albert of Monaco, a man who had been plagued by doubts of his virility, felt like an insatiable tiger after a night with Otero. She became his mistress. Other royalty followed. Prince Albert of Wales, later King Edward VII, the Shah of Persia, Grand Duke Nicholas of Russia. Less wealthy men emptied their bank accounts, and Jurgens was only the first of many whom Otero drove to suicide. During World War I, a 29-year-old American soldier named Frederick, stationed in France, won $37,000 in a four-day crap game. On his next leave, he went to Nice and checked himself into the finest hotel. On his first night in the hotel restaurant, he recognized Otero sitting alone at a table. He had seen her perform in Paris 10 years before and had become obsessed with her. She was now close to 50, but was more alluring than ever. He greased some palms and was able to sit at her table. He could hardly talk. The way her eyes bored into him, a simple readjustment in her chair, her body brushing up against him as she got up, the way she managed to walk in front of him and display herself. Later, strolling along a boulevard, they passed a jewelry store. He went inside, and moments later found himself plopping down $31,000 for a diamond necklace. For 3 nights, La Belle Otero was his. Never in his life had he felt so masculine and impetuous. Years later, he still believed it was well worth the price he had paid. Interpretation. Although La Belle Otero was beautiful, hundreds of women were more so, or were more charming and talented. But Otero was constantly on fire. Men could read it in her eyes, the way her body moved, a dozen other signs. The heat that radiated out from her came from her own inner desires. She was insatiably sexual. But she was also a practiced and calculating courtesan, and knew how to put her sexuality to effect. On stage, she made every man in the audience come alive, abandoning herself in dance. In person, she was cooler, or slightly so. A man likes to feel that a woman is inflamed not because she has an insatiable appetite, but because of him. So Otero personalized her sexuality, using glances, a brushing of skin, a more languorous tone of voice, a saucy comment, to suggest that the man was heating her up. In her memoirs, she revealed that Prince Albert was a most inept lover. Yet he believed, along with many other men, that with her, he was Hercules himself. Her sexuality actually originated from her, but she created the illusion that the man was the aggressor. The key to luring the target into the final act of your seduction is not to make it obvious, not to announce that you are ready to pounce or be pounced upon. Everything should be geared not to the conscious mind, but to the senses. You want your target to read cues not from your words or actions, but from your body. You must make your body glow with desire for the target. Your desire should be read in your eyes, in a trembling in your voice, in your reaction when your bodies draw near. You cannot train your body to act this way, but by choosing a victim, see Chapter 1, who has this effect on you, it will all flow naturally. During the seduction, you will have had to hold yourself back, to intrigue and frustrate the victim. You will have frustrated yourself in the process and will already be champing at the bit. Once you sense that the target has fallen for you and cannot turn back, let those frustrated desires course through your blood and warm you up. You don't need to touch your targets or become physical. As La Belle Otero understood, sexual desire is contagious. They will catch your heat and glow in return. Let them make the first move. It will cover your tracks. The second and third moves are yours. Lowering inhibitions. One day in 1931, in a village in New Guinea, a young girl named Tupper Salai heard some happy news. Her father, Alaman, who had left some months before to work on a tobacco plantation, had returned for a visit. Tupercellai ran to greet him. Accompanying her father was a white man, an unusual sight in these parts. He was a 22-year-old Australian from Tasmania, and he was the owner of the plantation. His name was Errol Flynn. Flynn smiled warmly at Tupercellai, seeming particularly interested in her bare breasts. As was the custom in New Guinea then, she wore only a grass skirt. He said in pidgin English how beautiful she was, and kept repeating her name, which he pronounced remarkably well. He did not say much else, mind you. He didn't speak her language. So she said goodbye and walked away with her father. But later that day she discovered, to her dismay, that Mr. Flynn had taken a liking to her and had purchased her from her father for 2 pigs, some English coins, and some seashell money. The family was poor, and the father liked the price. Tupercellai had a boyfriend in the village whom she did not want to leave, but she didn't dare disobey her father, and she left with Mr. Flynn for the tobacco plantation. On the other hand, she had no intention of being friendly with this man, from whom she expected the worst kind of treatment. In the first few days, Tupercellai missed her village terribly, and felt nervous and out of sorts. But Mr. Flynn was polite and talked in a soothing voice. She began to relax, and since he kept his distance, she decided it was safe to approach him. His white skin was tasty to the mosquitoes, so she began to wash him every night with scented bush herbs to keep them away. Soon she had a thought. Mr. Flynn was lonely and wanted a companion. That was why he had bought her. At night, he usually read. Instead, she began to entertain him by singing and dancing. Sometimes he tried to communicate in words and gestures, struggling in pidgin. She had no idea what he was trying to say, but he made her laugh, and one day she did understand something, the word swim. He was inviting her to go swimming with him in the Laloki River. She was happy to go along, but the river was full of crocodiles, so she brought along her spear, just in case. At the sight of the river, Mr. Flynn seemed to come alive. He tore off his clothes and dove in. She followed and swam after him. He put his arms around her and kissed her. They drifted downstream, and she clung to him. She had forgotten about the crocodiles. She had also forgotten about her father, her boyfriend, her village, and everything else there was to forget. Around a bend of the river, he picked her up and carried her to a secluded grove near the river's edge. It all happened rather suddenly, which was fine with Tupercellai. From then on, this was a daily ritual. The river, the grove, until the time came when the tobacco plantation was no longer doing so well, and Mr. Flynn left New Guinea. One day, some 10 years later, a young girl named Blanca Rosa Velter went to a party at the Ritz Hotel in Mexico City. As she wandered through the bar looking for her friends, a tall, older man blocked her path and said in a charming accent, "You must be Blanca Rosa." He did not have to introduce himself. He was the famous Hollywood actor Errol Flynn. His face was plastered on posters everywhere, and he was friends of the party's hosts, the Davises, and had heard them praise the beauty of Blanca Rosa, who was turning 18 the following day. He led her to a table in the corner. His manner was graceful and confident, and listening to him talk, she forgot about her friends. He spoke of her beauty, repeated her name, said he could make her a star. Before she knew what was happening, he had invited her to join him in Acapulco, where he was vacationing. The Davises, their mutual friends, could come along as chaperones. That would be wonderful, she said, but her mother would never agree. "Don't worry about that," Flynn replied, and the following day he showed up at their house with a beautiful gift for Blanca, a ring with her birthstone. Melting under his charming smile, Blanca's mother agreed to his plan. Later that day, Blanca found herself on a plane to Acapulco. It was all like a dream. The Davises, under orders from Blanca's mother, tried not to let her out of their sight, so Flynn put her on a raft, and they drifted out into the ocean, far from the shore. His flattering words filled her ears, and she let him hold her hand and kiss her cheek. That night they danced together, and when the evening was over, he escorted her to her room and serenaded her with a song as they finally parted. It was the end of a perfect day. In the middle of the night, she woke up to hear him calling her name from her hotel room balcony. How had he gotten there? His room was a floor above. He must have somehow jumped or swung down, a dangerous maneuver. She approached, not at all afraid, but curious. He pulled her gently into his arms and kissed her. Her body convulsed, overwhelmed with new sensations, totally at sea, she began to cry. Out of happiness, she said. Flynn comforted her with a kiss and returned to his room above in the same inexplicable way he had arrived. Now Blanca was hopelessly in love with him and would do anything he asked of her. A few weeks later, in fact, she followed him to Hollywood, where she went on to become a successful actress known as Linda Christian. In 1942, an 18-year-old girl named Nora Eddington had a temporary job selling cigarettes at the Los Angeles County Courthouse. The place was a madhouse at the time, teeming with tabloid journalists. Two young girls had charged Errol Flynn with rape. Nora, of course, noticed Flynn, a tall, dashing man who occasionally bought cigarettes from her, but her thoughts were with her boyfriend, a young Marine. A few weeks later, Flynn was acquitted, the trial ended, and the place settled down. A man she had met during the trial called her up one day. He was Flynn's right-hand man, and on Flynn's behalf, he wanted to invite her up to the actor's house on Mulholland Drive. Nora had no interest in Flynn, and in fact, she was a little afraid of him, but a girlfriend who was dying to meet him talked her into going and bringing her along. What did she have to lose? Nora agreed to go. On the day, Flynn's friend showed up and drove them to a splendid house on top of a hill. When they arrived, Flynn was standing shirtless by his swimming pool. He came to greet her and her girlfriend, moving so gracefully, like a lithe cat, and his manner so relaxed she felt her jitters melt away. He gave them a tour of the house, which was full of artifacts of his various sea voyages. He talked so delightfully of his love of adventure that she wished she had had adventures of her own. He was the perfect gentleman, and even let her talk about her boyfriend without the slightest sign of jealousy. Nora had a visit from her boyfriend the next day. Somehow, he didn't seem so interesting anymore. They had a fight and broke up on the spot. That night, Flynn took her out on the town to the famous Mocambo nightclub. He was drinking and joking, and she fell into the spirit and happily let him touch her hand. Then suddenly she panicked. "I'm a Catholic and a virgin," she blurted out, "and someday I'm going to walk down the church aisle wearing a veil, and if you think you're going to sleep with me, you're mistaken." Totally calm and unruffled, Flynn said she had nothing to fear. He simply liked being with her. She relaxed and politely asked him to put his hand back. Over the next few weeks, she saw him almost every day. She became his secretary. Soon she was spending weekend nights as his house guest. He took her on skiing and boating trips. He remained the perfect gentleman, but when he looked at her or touched her hand, she felt overwhelmed by an exhilarating sensation, a tingling on her skin that she compared to stepping into a cold needle shower on a red-hot day. Soon she was going to church less often, drifting away from the life she had known. Although outwardly nothing had changed between them, inwardly all semblance of resistance to him had melted away. One night, after a party, she succumbed. She and Flynn eventually engaged in a stormy marriage that lasted 7 years. Interpretation. The women who became involved with Errol Flynn, and by the end of his life they numbered in the thousands, had every reason in the world to feel suspicious of him. He was real life's closest thing to a Don Juan. In fact, he had played the legendary seducer in a film. He was constantly surrounded by women who knew that no involvement with him could last. And then there were the rumors of his temper and his love of danger and adventure. No woman had greater reason to resist him than Nora Eddington. When she met him, he stood accused of rape. She was involved with another man. She was a God-fearing Catholic. Yet she fell under his spell, just like all the rest. Some seducers, D.H. Lawrence, for instance, operate mostly on the mind, creating fascination, stirring up the need to possess them. Flynn operated on the body. His cool, nonchalant manner infected women, lowering their resistance. This happened almost the minute they met him, like a drug. He was at ease around women, graceful and confident. They fell into this spirit, drifting along on a current he created, leaving the world and its heaviness behind. It was only you and him. Then, perhaps that same day, perhaps a few weeks later, there would come a touch of his hand, a certain look that would make them feel a tingling, a vibration, a dangerously physical excitement. They would betray that moment in their eyes, a blush, a nervous laugh, and he would swoop in for the kill. No one moved faster than Errol Flynn. The greatest obstacle to the physical part of the seduction is the target's education, the degree to which he or she has been civilized and socialized. Such education conspires to constrain the body, dull the senses, fill the mind with doubts and worries. Flynn had the ability to return a woman to a more natural state, in which desire, pleasure, and sex had nothing negative attached to them. He lured women into adventure not with arguments, but with an open, unrestrained attitude that infected their minds. Understand, it all starts from you. When the time comes to make the seduction physical, train yourself to let go of your own inhibitions, your doubts, your lingering feelings of guilt and anxiety. Your confidence and ease will have more power to intoxicate the victim than all the alcohol you could apply. Exhibit a lightness of spirit. Nothing bothers you. Nothing daunts you. You take nothing personally. You are inviting your targets to shed the burdens of civilization, to follow your lead and drift. Don't talk of work, duty, marriage, the past or future. Plenty of other people will do that. Instead, offer the rare thrill of losing oneself in the moment, where the senses come alive and the mind is left behind. Keys to seduction. Now, more than ever, our minds are in a state of constant distraction, barraged with endless information, pulled in every direction. Many of us recognize the problem. Articles are written, studies are completed, but they simply become more information to digest. It's almost impossible to turn off an overactive mind. The attempt simply triggers more thoughts, an inescapable hall of mirrors. Perhaps we turn to alcohol, to drugs, to physical activity. Anything to help us slow the mind, be more present in the moment. Our discontent presents the crafty seducer with infinite opportunity. The waters around you are teeming with people seeking some kind of release from mental overstimulation. The lure of unencumbered physical pleasure will make them take your bait, but as you prowl the waters, understand the only way to relax a distracted mind is to make it focus on one thing. A hypnotist asks the patient to focus on a watch swinging back and forth. Once the patient focuses, the mind relaxes. The senses awaken. The body becomes prone to all kinds of novel sensations and suggestions. As a seducer, you are a hypnotist, and what you're making the target focus on is you. Throughout the seductive process, you've been filling the target's mind. Letters, mementos, shared experiences keep you constantly present, even when you're not there. Now, as you shift to the physical part of the seduction, you must see your targets more often. Your attention must become more intense. Errol Flynn was a master at this game. When he homed in on a victim, he dropped everything else. The woman was made to feel that everything came second to her, his career, his friends, everything. Then he would take her on a little trip, preferably with water around. Slowly, the rest of the world would fade into the background, and Flynn would take center stage. The more your targets think of you, the less they are distracted by thoughts of work and duty. When the mind focuses on one thing, it relaxes, and when the mind relaxes, all the little paranoid thoughts that we're prone to, do you really like me, am I intelligent or beautiful enough, what does the future hold, vanish from the surface. Remember, it all starts with you. Be undistracted, present in the moment, and the target will follow suit. The intense gaze of the hypnotist creates a similar reaction in the patient. Once the target's overactive mind starts to slow down, their senses will come to life, and your physical lures will have double their power. Now, a heated glance will give them flush. You will have a tendency to employ physical lures that work primarily on the eyes, the sense we most rely on in our culture. Physical appearances are critical, but you're after a general agitation of the senses. La Belle Otero made sure men noticed her breasts, her figure, her perfume, her walk. No part was allowed to predominate. The senses are interconnected. An appeal to smell will trigger touch. An appeal to touch will trigger vision. Casual or accidental contact, better a brushing of the skin than something more forceful right now, will create a jolt and activate the eyes. Subtly modulate the voice, make it slower and deeper. Living senses will crowd out rational thought. In the 18th century libertine novel, The Wayward Head and Heart, by Crébillon Fils, Madame de Lursay is trying to seduce a younger man, Maycourt. Her weapons are several. One night at a party she's hosting, she wears a revealing gown. Her hair is slightly tousled. She throws him heated glances. Her voice trembles a bit. When they're alone, she innocently gets him to sit close to her and talks more slowly. At one point, she starts to cry. Maycourt has many reasons to resist her. He's fallen in love with a girl his own age, and he's heard rumors about Madame de Lursay that should make him distrust her. But the clothes, the looks, the perfume, the voice, the closeness of her body, the tears, it all begins to overwhelm him. "An indescribable agitation stirred my senses," says Maycourt. Maycourt succumbs. The French libertines of the 18th century called this the moment. The seducer leads the victim to a point where he or she reveals involuntary signs of physical excitation that can be read in various symptoms. Once those signs are detected, the seducer must work quickly, applying pressure on the target to get lost in the moment. The past, the future, all moral scruples vanishing in air. Once your victims lose themselves in the moment, it's all over. Their mind, their conscience, no longer holds them back. The body gives in to pleasure. Madame de Lursay lures Maycourt into the moment by creating a generalized disorder of the senses, rendering him incapable of thinking straight. In leading your victims into the moment, remember a few things. First, a disordered look, Madame de Lursay's tousled hair, her ruffled dress, has more effect on the senses than a neat appearance. It suggests the bedroom. Second, be alert to the signs of physical excitation. Blushing, trembling of the voice, tears, unusually forceful laughter, relaxing movements of the body, any kind of involuntary mirroring, their gestures imitating yours, a revealing slip of the tongue. These are signs that the victim is slipping into the moment and pressure is to be applied. In 1934, a Chinese football player named Li met a young actress named Lan Ping in Shanghai. He began to see her often at his matches, cheering him on. They would meet at public affairs, and he would notice her glancing at him with her strange, yearning eyes, then looking away. One evening, he found her seated next to him at a reception. Her leg brushed up against his. They chatted, and she asked him to see a movie with her at a nearby cinema. Once they were there, her head found its way onto his shoulder. She whispered into his ear something about the film. Later, they strolled the streets, and she put her arm around his waist. She brought him to a restaurant where they drank some wine. Lee took her to his hotel room, and there he found himself overwhelmed by caresses and sweet words. She gave him no room to retreat, no time to cool down. 3 years later, Lan Ping, soon to be renamed Jiang Qing, played a similar game on Mao Zedong. She was to become Mao's wife, the infamous Madame Mao, leader of the Gang of Four. Seduction, like warfare, is often a game of distance and closeness. At first, you track your enemy from a distance. Your main weapons are your eyes and a mysterious manner. Byron had his famous underlook, Madame Mao, her yearning eyes. The key is to make the look short and to the point, then look away like a rapier glancing the flesh. Make your eyes reveal desire and keep the rest of the face still. A smile will spoil the effect. Once the victim is heated up, you quickly bridge the distance, turning to hand-to-hand combat in which you give the enemy no room to withdraw, no time to think or to consider the position in which you've placed him or her. To take the element of fear out of this, use flattery. Make the target feel more masculine or feminine. Praise their charms. It's their fault that you've become so physical and aggressive. There's no greater physical lure than to make the target feel alluring. Remember, the girdle of Aphrodite, which gave her untold seductive powers, included that of sweet flattery. Shared physical activity is always an excellent lure. The Russian mystic Rasputin would begin his seductions with a spiritual lure, the promise of a shared religious experience. But then his eyes would bore into his target at a party, and inevitably he would lead her in a dance, which would become more and more suggestive as he moved closer to her. Hundreds of women succumbed to this technique. For Flynn, it was swimming or sailing. In such physical activity, the mind turns off and the body operates according to its own laws. The target's body will follow your lead, will mirror your moves as far as you want it to go. In the moment, all moral considerations fade away, and the body returns to a state of innocence. You can partly create that feeling through a devil-may-care attitude. You don't worry about the world or what people think of you. You don't judge your target in any way. Part of Flynn's appeal was his total acceptance of a woman. He wasn't interested in a particular body type, a woman's race, her level of education, her political beliefs. He was in love with her feminine presence. He was luring her into an adventure, free of society's strictures and moral judgments. With him, she could act out a fantasy, which for many was the chance to be aggressive or transgressive, to experience danger. So, empty yourself of your tendency to moralize and judge. You have lured your targets into a momentary world of pleasure, soft and accommodating, all rules and taboos thrown out the window. Reversal. Some people panic when they sense they're falling into the moment. Often, using spiritual lures will help disguise the increasingly physical nature of the seduction. That is how the lesbian seductress Natalie Barney operated. In her heyday, at the turn of the 20th century, lesbian sex was immensely transgressive, and women new to it often felt a sense of shame or dirtiness. Barney led them into the physical, but so enveloped it in poetry and mysticism that they relaxed and felt purified by the experience. Today, few people feel repulsed by their sexual nature, but many are uncomfortable with their bodies. A purely physical approach will frighten and disturb them. Instead, make it seem a spiritual, mystical union, and they will take less notice of your physical manipulations. Chapter 23. Master the Art of the Bold Move. A moment has arrived. Your victim clearly desires you, but is not ready to admit it openly, let alone act on it. This is the time to throw aside chivalry, kindness, and coquetry, and to overwhelm with a bold move. Don't give the victim time to consider the consequences. Create conflict. Stir up tension so that the bold move comes as a great release. Showing hesitation or awkwardness means you're thinking of yourself as opposed to being overwhelmed by the victim's charms. Never hold back or meet the target halfway, under the belief that you're being correct and considerate. You must be seductive now, not political. One person must go on the offensive, and it is you. The perfect climax. Through a campaign of deception, the misleading appearance of a transformation into goodness, the rake Valmont laid siege to the virtuous young Président de Tourvel, until the day came when, disturbed by his confession of love for her, she insisted he leave the chateau where both of them were staying as guests. He complied. From Paris, however, he flooded her with letters, describing his love for her in the most intense terms. She begged him to stop, and once again he complied. Then, several weeks later, he paid a surprise visit to the chateau. In his company, Tourvel was flushed and jumpy and kept her eyes averted, all signs of his effect on her. Again she asked him to leave. "What have you to fear?" he replied. "I have always done what you asked. I have never forced myself on you." He kept his distance, and she slowly relaxed. She no longer left the room when he entered, and she could look at him directly. When he offered to accompany her on a walk, she didn't refuse. "They were friends," she said. She even put her arm in his as they strolled, a friendly gesture. One rainy day, they could not take their usual walk. He met her in the hallway as she was entering her room. For the first time, she invited him in. She seemed relaxed, and Valmont sat near her on a sofa. He talked of his love for her. She gave the faintest protest. He took her hand. She left it there and leaned against his arm. Her voice trembled. She looked at him, and he felt his heart flutter. It was a tender, loving look. She started to speak. "Well, yes, I..." then suddenly collapsed into his arms, crying. It was a moment of weakness, yet Valmont held himself back. Her crying became convulsive. She begged him to help her to leave the room before something terrible happened. He did so. The following morning he awoke to some surprising news. In the middle of the night, claiming she was feeling ill, Tourvel had suddenly left the chateau and returned home. Valmont didn't follow her to Paris. Instead, he began staying up late and using no powder to hide the piqued looks that soon ensued. He went to the chapel every day and dragged himself despondently around the chateau. He knew that his hostess would be writing to the President, who would hear of his sad state. Next, he wrote to a church father in Paris and asked him to pass along a message to Tourvel. He was ready to change his life for good. He wanted one last meeting to say goodbye and to return the letters she had written him over the last few months. The father arranged a meeting, and so, one late afternoon in Paris, Valmont found himself once again alone with Tourvel in a room in her house. The President was clearly on edge, but she couldn't look him in the eye. They exchanged pleasantries, but then Valmont turned harsh. She had treated him cruelly, had apparently been determined to make him unhappy. Well, this was the end. They were separating for good, since that was how she wanted it. Tourvel argued back. She was a married woman. She had no choice. Valmont softened his tone and apologized. He was unused to having such strong feelings, he said, and could not control himself. Still, he would never trouble her again. Then he laid on a table the letters he had come to return. Tourvel came closer. The sight of her letters and the memory of all the turmoil they represented affected her powerfully. She had thought his decision to renounce his libertine way of life was voluntary, she said. with a touch of bitterness in her voice, as if she resented being abandoned. "No, it wasn't voluntary," he replied. "It was because she had spurned him." Then he suddenly stepped closer and took her in his arms. She did not resist. "Adorable woman," he cried. "You have no idea of the love you inspire. You will never know how I have worshipped you, how much dearer my feelings have been to me than life. May your days be blessed with all of the happiness of which you have deprived me." Then he let her go and turned to leave. Tourvel suddenly snapped. "You shall listen to me. I insist," she said, and grabbed his arm. He turned around, and they embraced. This time, he waited no longer, picking her up, carrying her to an ottoman, overwhelming her with kisses and sweet words of the happiness he now felt. Before this sudden flood of caresses, all her resistance gave way. "From this moment on, I am yours," she said, "and you will hear neither refusals nor regrets from my lips." Tourvel was true to her word, and Valmont's suspicions were to prove correct. The pleasures he won from her were far greater than with any other woman he had seduced. Interpretation. Valmont, a character in Chaudarlot de Laclos' 18th-century novel Dangerous Liaisons, can sense several things about the président at first glance. She is timid and nervous. Her husband almost certainly treats her with respect, probably too much of it. Beneath her interest in God, religion, and virtue is a passionate woman, vulnerable to the lure of romance and to the flattering attention of an ardent suitor. No one, not even her husband, has given her this feeling because they have all been so daunted by her prudish exterior. Valmont begins his seduction, then, by being indirect. He knows Tourvel is secretly fascinated with his bad reputation. By acting as if he is contemplating a change in his life, he can make her want to reform him, a desire that is unconsciously a desire to love him. Once she has opened up ever so slightly to his influence, he strikes at her vanity. She has never felt desired as a woman, and on some level cannot help but enjoy his love for her. Of course, she struggles and resists, but that is only a sign that her emotions are engaged. Indifference is the single most effective deterrent to seduction. By taking his time, by making no bold moves even when he has the opportunity for them, he instills in her a false sense of security and proves himself by being patient. On what he pretends is his last visit to her, however, he can sense she's ready. Weak, confused, more afraid of losing the addictive feeling of being desired than of suffering the consequences of adultery. He deliberately makes her emotional, dramatically displays her letters, creates some tension by playing a game of push and pull, and when she takes his arm, he knows it is the time to strike. Now he moves quickly, allowing her no time for doubts or second thoughts. But his move seems to arise out of love, not lust. After so much resistance and tension, what a pleasure to finally surrender. The climax now comes as a great release. Never underestimate the role of vanity in love and seduction. If you seem impatient, champing at the bit for sex, you signal that it's all about libido and that it has little to do with the target's own charms. That is why you must defer the climax. A lengthier courtship will feed the target's vanity and will make the effect of your bold move all the more powerful and enduring. Wait too long, though, showing desire but then proving too timid to make your move, and you will stir up a different kind of insecurity. You found me desirable, but you're not acting on your desires. Maybe you're not so interested. Doubts like these affront your target's vanity. If you're not interested, maybe I'm not so interesting, and are fatal in the latter stages of seduction. Awkwardness and misunderstandings will spring up everywhere. Once you read in your target's gestures that they are ready and open, a look in the eye, mirroring behavior, a strange nervousness in your presence, you must go on the offensive. Make them feel that their charms have unhinged you and pushed you into the bold move. They will then have the ultimate pleasure, physical surrender, and a psychological boost to their vanity. Keys to seduction. Think of seduction as a world you enter, a world that is separate and distinct from the real world. The rules are different here. What works in daily life can have the opposite effect in seduction. The real world features a democratizing, leveling impulse in which everything has to seem at least something like equal. An overt imbalance of power, an overt desire for power, will stir envy and resentment. We learn to be kind and polite, at least on the surface. Even those who have power generally try to act humble and modest. They don't want to offend. In seduction, on the other hand, you can throw all of that out. Revel in your dark side. Inflict a little pain. In some ways, be more yourself. Your naturalness in this respect will prove seductive in itself. The problem is that after years of living in the real world, we lose the ability to be ourselves. We become timid, humble, over-polite. Your task is to regain some of your childhood qualities, to root out all this false humility. And the most important quality to recapture is boldness. No one is born timid. Timidity is a protection we develop. If we never stick our necks out, if we never try, we will never have to suffer the consequences of failure or success. If we're kind and unobtrusive, no one will be offended. In fact, we will seem saintly and likable. In truth, timid people are often self-absorbed, obsessed with the way people see them, and not at all saintly. And humility may have its social uses, but it is deadly in seduction. You need to be able to play the humble saint at times. It is a mask you wear. But in seduction, take it off. Boldness is bracing, erotic, and absolutely necessary to bring the seduction to its conclusion. Done right, it tells your targets that they have made you lose your normal restraint and gives them license to do so as well. People are yearning to have a chance to play out the repressed sides of their personality. At the final stage of a seduction, boldness eliminates any awkwardness or doubts. In a dance, two people cannot lead. One takes over, sweeping the other along. Seduction is not egalitarian. It's not a harmonic convergence. Holding back at the end out of fear of offending or thinking it correct to share the power is a recipe for disaster. This is an arena not for politics, but for pleasure. It can be by the man or woman, but a bold move is required. If you are so concerned about the other person, console yourself with the thought that the pleasure of the one who surrenders is often greater than that of the aggressor. As a young man, the actor Errol Flynn was uncontrollably bold. This often got him into trouble. He became too aggressive around desirable women. Then, while traveling through the Far East, he became interested in the Asian practice of tantric sex, in which the male must train himself not to ejaculate, preserving his potency and heightening both partners' pleasure in the process. Flynn later applied this principle to his seductions as well, teaching himself to restrain his natural boldness and delay the end of the seduction as long as possible. So, while boldness can work wonders, uncontrollable boldness is not seductive, but frightening. You need to be able to turn it on and off at will. Know when to use it. As in tantrism, you can create more pleasure by delaying the inevitable. In the 1720s, the Duc de Richelieu developed an infatuation with a certain duchess. The woman was exceptionally beautiful and was desired by one and all, but she was far too virtuous to take a lover, although she could be quite coquettish. Richelieu bided his time. He befriended her, charming her with the wit that had made him the favorite of the ladies. One night, a group of such women, including the Duchess, decided to play a practical joke on him, in which he was to be forced naked out of his room at the Palace of Versailles. The joke worked to perfection. The ladies all got to see him in his native glory, and had a good chuckle watching him run away. There were many places Richelieu could have hidden. The place he chose was the Duchess's bedroom. Minutes later, he watched her enter and undress, and once the candles were extinguished, he crept into bed with her. She protested, tried to scream. He covered her mouth with kisses, and she eventually and happily relented. Richelieu had decided to make his bold move then for several reasons. First, the Duchess had come to like him, and even to harbor a secret desire for him. She would never act upon it or admit it, but he was certain it existed. Second, she had seen him naked, and could not help but be impressed. Third, she would feel a touch of pity for his predicament and for the joke played on him. Richelieu, a consummate seducer, would find no more perfect moment. The bold move should come as a pleasant surprise, but not too much of a surprise. Learn to read the signs that the target is falling for you. His or her manner toward you will have changed. It will be more pliant, with more words and gestures mirroring yours, yet there will still be a touch of nervousness and uncertainty. Inwardly, they have given in to you, but they don't expect a bold move. This is the time to strike. If you wait too long, to the point where they consciously desire and expect you to make a move, it loses the piquancy of coming as a surprise. You want a degree of tension and ambivalence so that the move represents a great release. Their surrender will relieve tension like a long-awaited summer storm. Don't plan your bold move in advance. It cannot seem calculated. Wait for the opportune moment, as Richelieu did. Be attentive to favorable circumstances. This will give you room to improvise and go with the moment, which will heighten the impression you want to create of being suddenly overwhelmed by desire. If you ever sense that the victim is expecting the bold move, take a step back. Lull them into a false sense of security, then strike. Sometime in the 15th century, the writer Bandello relates, a young Venetian widow had a sudden lust for a handsome nobleman. She had her father invite him to their palace to discuss business, but during the meeting the father had to leave, and she offered to give the young man a tour of the place. His curiosity was piqued by her bedroom, which she described as the most splendid room in the palace, but which she also passed by without letting him enter. He begged to be shown the room, and she granted his wish. He was spellbound. The velvets, the rare objets, the suggestive paintings, the delicate white candles. A beguiling scent filled the room. The widow put out all of the candles but one, then led the man to the bed, which had been heated with a warming pan. He quickly succumbed to her caresses. Follow the widow's example. Your bold move should have a theatrical quality to it. That will make it memorable and make your aggressiveness seem pleasant, part of the drama. The theatricality can come from the setting, an exotic or sensual location. It can also come from your actions. The widow piqued her victim's curiosity by creating the suspense about her bedroom. An element of fear, someone might find you, say, will heighten the tension. Remember, you're creating a moment that must stand out from the sameness of daily life. Keeping your targets emotional will both weaken them and heighten the drama of the moment, and the best way to keep them at an emotional pitch is by infecting them with emotions of your own. When Valmont wanted the president to become calm, angry, or tender, he showed that emotion first, and she mirrored it. People are very susceptible to the moods of those around them. This is particularly acute at the latter stages of a seduction, when resistance is low and the target has fallen under your spell. At the point of the bold move, Learn to infect your target with whatever emotional mood you require, as opposed to suggesting the mood with words. You want access to the target's unconscious, which is best obtained by infecting them with emotions, bypassing their conscious ability to resist. It may seem expected for the male to make the bold move,